Echo Flight is another squadron, I'd say probably 50, 60 miles away from our location, but they had the same sort of thing happen. They had UFOs that were hovering, not at the launch control facility but at the actual launch facilities where the missiles are located. They had some maintenance and security people out there at the time and they observed the UFOs at those sites. Now they lost all 10 of their weapons, all 10. It was the same morning. So that morning we lost anywhere from between 16 to 18 ICBMs at the same time UFOs were in the area and were observed by airmen. Those missiles were down the entire day because we've got testimony from Colonel Don Crawford, who relieved the crew at Echo Flight, and he was there when the missiles were being brought up to alert status and he said it took the whole day. So I'm assuming it took our missiles all day to be brought back up also. I wrote up a report about this incident, it was in my log and I turned it in. When we got to the base we had to report to our squadron commander right away. And in that room with my squadron commander was a fellow from a FOSI. We had an Air Force Office of Special Investigations on the base. He was there in the office with the commander. He asked for my logs and he wanted a quick briefing, although it seemed to me he knew pretty much what had happened already. But we gave him a quick briefing and then he asked us both to sign a non-disclosure agreement saying this was classified information, we were not to release this to anybody, and that was it. We couldn't talk, he told us we could not talk about this to anyone, including any of the other crews, our spouses, our family, even amongst each other. I've got a copy of a telex which we received under FOIA coming from SAC headquarters and coming to Maelstrom and other bases right after the morning that happened, saying that this incident was of extreme concern to SAC headquarters because they couldn't explain it. Nobody could explain what happened. And yet we never got briefed. And we were cleared for very high classification because these are nuclear weapons we're dealing with. We did get the security incursion alarms at those sites when the missile went down. That is unusual because usually when a missile went down for something like guidance failure, we wouldn't get security incursion alarms, which means a perimeter is breached, an object crossed the fence, or something broke the security alarm system that we had on the perimeter of the launch facility. I did send out guards to a couple of those facilities to investigate that. The reason I think this story is very significant is because, going back to August of 1966 at Minute, ND, a very similar thing happened at one of the launch control facilities at Minute Air Force Base. They had the same kind of weapon system that we had. They had M1 missiles. This UFO was observed on radar. There was some communication failure and the object was observed over the launch control facility. That happened in August 1966 and that's a well-documented incident. About a week prior to my incident, in March 1967, I've got a record of a call from one of the security guards who was out roaming looking at the launch facilities and saw an object very similar to what I just described over the launch facility. Bob Kominski headed up the organization to look at all aspects of these shutdowns. Kominski relates to me in writing that at some point he was told by his boss that the Air Force said, "Stop the investigation, do no more on this and in addition do not write a final report." Again, this is very unusual, especially in light of the fact that SINC, SAC headquarters was stating that this was of extreme importance to find out exactly what happened here. And yet, the head of the investigative team was told during the investigation to stop the investigation and not write a final report. Professor Robert Jacobs, Lieutenant U.S. Air Force, we sent their UFO film back down to the base and, I don't know exactly how long it was after the event, it might have been a day or two, I was called into Major Mansman's office at the 1st Strategic Aerospace Division headquarters. I walked into his office and they had a screen and a 16mm projector set up. There was a couch and Major Mansman said, "Sit down." And there were two guys in gray suits, civilian clothes, which was fairly unusual. Major Mansman said, "Watch this," and turned on the film projector. I watched the screen and there was the launch from the day or two before. We watched the third stage burnout. And then on that telescope we could see the dummy warhead. It's flying along and into the frame came something else. It flew into the frame like and it shot a beam of light at the warhead. Now remember, all this stuff is flying at several thousand miles an hour. So this thing, UFO, fires a beam of light at the warhead, hits it and then it, the UFO, moves to the other side and fires another beam of light, then moves again and fires another beam of light, then goes down and fires another beam of light, and then flies out the way it came in. And the warhead tumbles out of space. The object, the points of light that we saw, the warhead and so forth, were traveling through subspace about 60 miles straight up. And they were going somewhere in the neighborhood of 11,000 to 14,000 miles an hour when this UFO caught up to them, flew in, flew around them, and flew back out. Now, I saw that. I don't give a goddamn what anybody else says about it. I saw that on film. I was there. Now when the lights came on, Major Mansman turned around, looked at me and said, "Were you guys screwing around up there?" And I said, "No, sir." And he said, "What was that?" And I said, "It looks to me like we got a UFO." Now the thing that we saw, this object that flew in, was circular, was shaped like two saucers cupped together with a ping, pong ball on top. The beam of light came out of the ping, pong ball. That's what I saw on film. Now Major Mansman said to me after some discussion about it, "You are never to speak of this again. As far as you are concerned, this never happened." And he said, "I don't need to emphasize the DIACON, sequences of a security breach, do I?" I said, "No, sir." And he said, "Fine. This never happened." As I started for the door, he said, "Wait a minute." He said, "Years from now, if you are ever forced by someone to talk about this, you are to tell them it was laser strikes, laser tracking strikes. It's not a second-hand story. This happened to me. And I was a part of a United States Air Force cover, up for 18 years. Colonel Ross Didrikson, U.S. Air Force, ec, ret, Colonel Didrikson is a retired colonel from the USAF. He went to Stanford Business School where he studied management. Back in the 1950s, part of his responsibilities included maintaining the inventory of the nuclear weapons stockpile for the ECHA and accompanying security teams checking out the security of the weapons. Many reports kept coming in that UFOs were seen at various nuclear storage facilities and some of the manufacturing plants. He has seen them himself many times and was present when the famous fly over the Capitol happened in July of 1952. At that incident he recalls seeing 9 illuminated disc-type craft. He also tells of at least 2 occasions where extraterrestrials destroyed nuclear weapons headed out to space, one heading to the moon to be detonated for tests. It was destroyed because nuclear weapons in space were not acceptable to the extraterrestrials. Government insiders / NASA / deep insiders Merle Shane McDow, U.S. Navy Atlantic Command. Mr. McDow entered the Navy in 1978 and gained a top, secret, special compartmented intelligence, SCI, clearance with a zebra stripes. He was assigned to the Atlantic Operational Support Facility, Atlantic Command, then under Admiral Tran. Mr. McDow was present when a UFO was tracked by radar and seen by pilots visually moving at high speed up and down the Atlantic coast. The command center was put on zebra alert and Admiral Tran gave the order to force down the UFO. Mr. McDow discusses the threats, intimidation and confiscation of logbooks that occurred after the event, and the early warning system. I believe it came in from an Air Force base in Greenland or Nova Scotia at that time, said that we had contact with an unidentified flying object that had entered our airspace. And within minutes Admiral Tran was rushed into the command center into his viewing booth that he had right under the mezzanine there and the first thing that Admiral Tran wanted to know was how many contacts we had, where they were, which direction were they going and were the Soviets responding. Because we knew that it wasn't the Soviets that had entered our airspace. That was verified from the get-go, from the start. At that point, when Admiral Tran found out that it wasn't the Soviets and that he wanted to know were the Soviets responding to this threat also, that was the moment that he gave authorization to put two planes up to go see what this thing was. And that was when the chasing up and down the eastern seaboard began. We launched planes from as far north as Greenland and as Naval Air Station, Oceania. This object, we had it on radar. This event lasted almost an hour. You could hear the pilots' live voice transmissions being piped into the command center. And they had visual confirmation of the object and made descriptions of the object. Pilots were able to close a couple of times and were able to see that the object was not an aircraft that we were familiar with. It was nothing that we had and nothing that the Soviets had. That was deter mine very quickly. This vehicle or whatever it was that they were chasing showed very erratic flight up and down the coast, quick flight. 1 minute it was here and the next minute bam, it was down several hundred miles down the coast, just playing tag. The photographs that we did get back in the command center later on came from the first encounters that the planes had with it off of the northern North American coast. They did get close enough to get some photographs taken that were later brought over to the command center. What was really bugging Admiral Tran, what was really driving him nuts, was this thing absolutely had complete control of the situation and could be anywhere that it wanted to be in a matter of seconds. 1 minute we were closing on it off the coast of Maine, and the next minute it is in Norfolk heading south towards Florida. And it is all that we can do to get the early warning radar up and down the coast to watch for this thing as it just had it stay with us. Admiral Tran and his staff were quite concerned about it to say the least. They were quite concerned especially once they found out that it wasn't the Russians and it wasn't us and he wasn't aware of anyone else who had the technology to build such a craft that could move about so easily and so quickly. I remember distinctly looking over the rail of the mezzanine and just watching complete chaos break out because of their inability to keep an eye on this thing, whatever it was. The UFO was moving around so erratically and so quickly up and down the coast. They were trying to notify as many commands as they could up and down the coast to track this thing or get a plane up. Admiral Tran was scrambling and authorizing planes just left and right, up and down the whole eastern seaboard to try and cut this thing off and to get some planes from the north and south to literally track it and to force it down. It was clear that they wanted to recover it, to force it down, by whatever means possible. The order was given by Admiral Tran to try and get this object forced down out of the sky, if at all possible, by whatever means possible. When this event, as I refer to it, ended, the object that we had been chasing up and down the seaboard headed out over the Atlantic, over the Azores. I do remember them saying that it had pulled up at a 66-degree angle as it approached the Azores like this, and it just pulled up at a 66-degree angle, without slowing down or anything, and left the atmosphere and was gone into space. It just took off into space and was gone like that, snaps fingers. I mean it just absolutely left. You are talking about something that covered thousands of miles in a blink of an eye and it was just gone and it just left everyone sitting around scratching their heads. Gee whiz, I wonder what that was. It was comical in a way to see how the vast military might of the United States was put on its knees by something they had no idea what it was, where it came from, where it was going or anything. The only thing that they knew for sure was that it wasn't the Soviets and they were very adamant about finding that out. If this object had been hostile and wanted to drop weapons or shoot missiles at us or whatever, it would have been very easy for them to do that. There was no question about that. We didn't have anything at that time that could hold a candle to whatever this was. And it just had its own free run of our airspace and could do anything it wanted as far as traveling. We did not pose any threat to it whatsoever. That was painfully obvious, very much so. I do believe that Admiral Tran knew that too and was quite afraid. Just in a word I would say that that old boy was just plain scared. I would say that the facilities that actually had this UFO on radar, there were five that I am sure of and that is from Greenland all the way to Florida, and there may be some others that I don't know. I know this because Admiral Tran was giving orders to Nezo Senior, let's get some planes up from there, scramble some fighters. He did make a call for them to alert Dover Air Force Base, Patuxent River, Maryland, Cecil Field down in Florida. Admiral Lord Hill, Norton, 5, Star Admiral, former head of the British Ministry of Defence. Lord Hill, Norton is a 5, Star Admiral and the former head of the British Ministry of Defence who was kept in the dark about the UFO subject during his official capacities. In this short interview, he states that this subject has great significance and should no longer be denied and kept secret. He emphatically states that there is a serious possibility that we are being visited, and have been visited for many years, by people from outer space, from other civilizations, that it behooves us to find out who they are, where they come from, and what they want. This should be the subject of rigorous scientific investigation, and not the subject of rubbishing by tabloid newspapers. Sergeant Clifford Stone, United States Army. Sergeant Stone tells an amazing story about the history of UFOs and extraterrestrials dating back to the early 40s and probably before. General Douglas MacArthur organized a group called the Interplanetary Phenomena Research Unit back in 1943 to study this issue, and it continues to this day. Their purpose is to recover objects of unknown origin, particularly those that are of non-earthly origin. They obtain field intelligence information and pass it on to those who are the keepers of this information. Stone says that even Project Blue Book had an elite investigation unit, which was outside of Blue Book. This unit was thought to be working in conjunction with Blue Book, but in fact was not. Stone has seen living and dead extraterrestrials in his official duties on an army team that retrieved crashed ET crafts. He thinks that the extraterrestrials will not permit us to explore the depths of outer space until we've learned to grow spiritually, and that they will make themselves known soon if we don't first acknowledge their presence. Mr. Don Phillips, Lockheed Skunk Works, USAF, and CIA contractor. Don Phillips was in the Air Force at Las Vegas Air Force Base during an event when UFOs were seen moving at enormous speeds near Mount Charleston, northwest of Las Vegas. In addition, he worked with Kelly Johnson at the Lockheed Skunk Works on design and construction of the U-2 and the SR-71 Blackbird. He testifies that we not only have these extraterrestrial devices, but have also achieved tremendous technological advances from their study. He states that in the 1950s and 1960s, NATO did research into the origin of ET races, and disseminated reports to the leaders of various countries. Mr. Phillips further states that there are records and filmed documentation of meetings in California in 1954 between ETs and leaders of the USA. He lists a few of the technologies we were able to develop because of the ETs: computer chips, lasers, night vision, bulletproof vests, and concludes, are these ET people hostile? Well, if they were hostile, with their weaponry they could have destroyed us a long time ago, or could have done some damage. Mr. Phillips now develops technologies that can help eliminate environmental pollutants and reduce the need for fossil fuels, such as energy generation systems that use natural energies from planet Earth. Technology, science. Mr. Fred Thrulfell, Royal Canadian Air Force. Mr. Thrulfell was a communications instructor in the Royal Canadian Air Force at CAF Station Toronto in 1953, when he witnessed an experiment involving the successful dematerialization and re-materialization of an object. Because of his top clearance, he was also able to check out from the base library original films of gun camera footage from WEI planes. Many times, while watching these films, he noticed UFOs in the footage, different positions, different shapes, but definitely UFOs. He has also himself seen UFOs maneuvering in the sky. There is a very powerful cell involving a former Secretary of State, U.S. President and former Secretary of Defense, most now involved in global financial enterprises. The chairman of AT&T was there, and the former head of SRI, Stanford Research Institute, was present. I was there to present to them what we knew and to discuss our plans for the future. Sitting next to me was the former chairman of SRI. At one point he leaned into me and said, "You know, I never knew any of this, but I knew some of it had to be going on at SRI. What do you know about such and such?" He explained that, like the CIA director I briefed, he was an administrator, but did not have a need to know, and was left in the dark about such projects. He said, "I was basically a bureaucrat, a bagman, trying to keep the money flowing into this huge operation. But if DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Projects Administration, had a project going on, I really didn't know any details. I might hear a whisper here and there. But these projects were tightly controlled, and it didn't matter that I was the chairman of SRI. And the way I got there was to know you don't ask too many questions. So now I want to ask you." During the Iran-Contra hearings, Senator Inouye stated that there is a shadowy group that has its own air force, its own navy, its own funding mechanism, and is above the law. This is especially true in the areas of advanced covert technologies, UFO and extraterrestrial matters, and related weapons systems. One of the most dangerous trends that has evolved between the 1960s and today is that this shadow government became so powerful because it was able to be self-funded. Now, let me explain. Dick D'Amato of the Senate Appropriations Committee was right when he said that there's upwards of $100 billion in the black, illegal budget. But the big action is in the corporate, private financial world. Let's say that you're Bell Labs at Murray Hill. I'm working with a witness who spent his entire career at Bell Labs. He was part of a cell that did a lot of super, secret covert contracting with military operations that had extraterrestrial communications devices and circuits. These corporate labs studied the technologies and uncovered how they worked and their possible uses. They came out with widget or X that then became something they patented, which in turn became a multi-hundred, billion-dollar industry. Think fiber optics, integrated circuits, lasers and the like. This cancer of covert government funding metastasized into countless corporate, financial and technological assets. And now the covert private corporate world has technologies that can trump anything at DIA, CIA or any of the other alphabet soup of government agencies. Another corporate witness whom I have interviewed said that while at Bell Labs, he saw 28 or 29 of these free energy devices that they had acquired and black, shelved or hidden. This witness had worked on these technologies. He's retired now. General Motors and other large corporations are also sitting on Earth, saving technologies but will not let them out to the public. So these interlocking, multinational corporate and financial interests are a multi-trillion-dollar operation that trumps any power of the Pentagon or the United States government or any nation on Earth. It is a monster of unchecked, corrupt corporate and covert power that is only partially governmental. So, unfortunately, even if you have a powerful person in what people call the government who may want the truth out, he feels overwhelmed by these other special interests. I spoke to a member of Congress in February of 2004 who was on the Congressional Energy Committee. When he was at a meeting with Cheney, he said, "Cheney ran the meeting and thinks exactly like an oil executive, he views everything as an oil executive, and that's it. What you have is the corporatization of the government, of all governments of the world, into a certain agenda." One of the men that I've worked with for years is a covert corporate operative involved in these types of operations. When I asked him to come forward, he said, "There is no agency or government on earth that can protect me from the wrath of this group, because it's outside these governments, and much more powerful." Now, when you have something this large and complex, you have people involved with both joint interests and separate interests. And the more separate the interests become, the more likelihood there is of a break. Away rogue group. The most violent rogue operations are the ones that are connected to ideology, as opposed to just money, and are rooted in a certain ideological and eschatological world view. These are the people who have a worldview of destruction and feel that the only way for Christ to come back is for the world to be destroyed and for billions of people to be killed. There is a very powerful group that holds to that belief system. But they really are looking in their rearview mirror. What they are awaiting has already come to pass. They don't know what cycle we are in already, never mind what century we're in. So, they're completely off the timeline of the evolution of the human race, but don't know it. They are driving the world in a certain direction, to fulfill their interpretation of a prophecy, which has already happened. Alas, it may be a self-fulfilling prophecy of Armageddon, one that they create through ignorance, superstition and hatred. So, ultimately, the problem is ignorance, and the solution is enlightenment, knowledge and genuine spirituality. The problem seems complex, but it can be very simply fixed. Where there is darkness, you introduce light. So, what we need to do is shed light on this issue and some perspective that allows people to understand that they do not need to engage in global supremacy or global destruction, in order to have their dreams come true. I remind people of the fact that no less a figure than Reagan's Interior Secretary, James Watt, after a meeting during the Reagan years, said something to the effect of, "All these environmentalists, they don't need to really worry about the environment, because the end of the world is coming soon and Christ is returning, and the world's going to be destroyed anyway. God wants us good Christians just to go ahead and use it up while we still have time." I am paraphrasing, but this is essentially what the man who was in charge of policy for the entire interior of America said. People need to understand that these types of superstitious and retrograde belief systems actually drive decisions and policies. It's a tragedy. Now, it's not talked about. Watt's comment was a slip of tongue that he didn't know was being recorded or heard. But I have met with many people at that level of influence, and they really hold to that belief. At this point in time, the US government is fully infiltrated and run by people with this end of their world belief system. Think about it, if that is your belief, you don't really care if there's global warming or an $8 trillion debt, because if, indeed, these are the end days, and the world's going to come to an end and all life on earth is going to end and the good Christians are going to float up into the sky to Jesus, who cares? This may sound bizarre to the average person. But an eschatological worldview drives much of the world's covert decision making, especially since the structure of that group is heavily dominated by covert Mormon, Vatican and other extremist religious interests. I have met directly with such interests. Of course, there are others involved in the covert world who are only interested in conventional greed, power, money, and control. And still others who are concerned with homeostasis. Let's not rock the boat, even if the boat's getting ready to go over Niagara Falls. There are different agendas operating, but the ones that have the most power are the ones that are the most bizarre, those rooted in retrograde cult, like religiosity and superstition. George Santayana was so right when he said, "Fanaticism consists of redoubling your efforts when you've forgotten your goal." From a fanatical end of their world perspective, it makes sense to add $500 billion a year in debt to add to an $8 trillion debt to pass on to our children. It makes sense to hold up, for decades, technologies that could save the Earth even though you know both polar ice caps are melting. And why not allow thousands of species of plants and animals to become extinct? The world is ending anyway. No one would stay on this course while also knowing the solution, unless they had clearly fixed in their mind this eschatological paradigm. Once I discovered this covert agenda of global destruction, everything fell into place. I began to meet with people who were satanic cultists, who were involved in these rogue breakaway groups. They are addicted to destruction and love torture, suffering and sadism. And it turns out they are the other side of the mask of those who pray for the end of their world. It is a very strange group of bedfellows. They think it's the literal end of the world, when in reality it is the end of one divine cycle and the opening of another. This singular misinterpretation of scripture and prophecy has enormous consequences, consequences. The solution, as I see it, is to put out a different perspective. Yes, we can talk about the end of one cycle. It is the end of one world. The old world. But it doesn't mean we have to sit back while we literally destroy the Earth. We may not necessarily be able to change them.